Good morning. Sweeping global tariffs are back as President Trump finds a novel legal argument to target U.S. imports.
This is really, again, the first time that they've used multiple countries at once. This is most of our major trading partners all lumped into this one single action.
How the prediction markets went haywire for LeBron James' next decision, and the Viking ship company taking issue with the makers of the Odyssey. It's Friday, July 24th. I'm Gideon Resnick in for Shamit Tabasu. This is Apple News Today. The Trump administration has announced double-digit tariffs for 60 economies, citing concerns about forced labor. The new duties take effect today and will hit the vast majority of U.S. trading partners.
On the lower end of the spectrum, trading partners will get a 10% tariff, and that ranges up to a 12.5% tariff.
That's Alicia Diaz, a trade reporter at Bloomberg. She writes that this marks the broadest increase in tariffs since Trump's so-called Liberation Day in early 2025. Those were eventually struck down by the Supreme Court, which ruled that Trump lacked the authority to act without Congress.
And so the administration came back and said, okay, what are some of the other legal avenues that we can use to add duties back onto our trading partners and continue this ongoing effort to bring manufacturing back to America?
Diaz told us that the Trump administration is relying on Section 301 of the 1974 Trade Act, which allows the president to impose tariffs on foreign countries that engage in unreasonable or discriminatory trade practices.
It's traditionally been used for kind of specific cases like China, and Trump's first administration was targeted under this legal jurisdiction. But this is really, again, the first time that they've used multiple countries at once.
And this latest argument follows an investigation from the U.S. Trade Representative looking into how nations handle goods allegedly produced by forced labor.
They concluded that about 60 economies were either using forced labor or they had forced labor enforcement in place and they weren't efficiently regulating those actions. And so some trading partners have their response, which is, you know, we're doing a lot on the forced labor front, and it will be interesting to see if there are legal challenges and how those stand up in court.
After the Supreme Court ruling, the Trump administration regrouped and looked for other ways to enact Trump's agenda. And recently, we've seen an uptick in announcements.
We saw this week that Trump tariffed Canada, many of Canadian goods, 50%, and he also announced the results of an investigation for Brazil, which was an ongoing probe, and they're being hit with a number of duties as well.
Countries will need to make their case for exemptions as they look to restore the trade deals they negotiated with the Trump administration last year in response to the Liberation Day tariffs. Earlier this week, U.S. Trade Representative Jamison Greer outlined the administration's commitment on Capitol Hill.
The specific authorities this administration is using have changed, but the trade strategy has not. We are committed to continuing to use tariffs and to negotiate deals to support the reindustrialization of our economy, protect American workers and increase their wages, and shrink our trade deficit.
The tariffs imposed today replaced a 10% global import tax that Trump brought in after the Supreme Court ruling. And according to the Washington Post, more tariffs based around countries that subsidize excess manufacturing capacity could soon be on the way. The death of 18-year-old Nolan Wells in Mississippi has drawn national attention from elected officials, civil rights activists, and celebrities as his family searches for answers. Wells, a black college freshman, was found dead earlier this month after taking a boat to an island with friends to celebrate July 4th, staying behind after most of them returned to the mainland. Authorities suspect he drowned and don't believe there was foul play. Officials have not released their autopsy, but in the absence of a full record of events, online speculation has filled a vacuum. The former NFL quarterback and now civil rights activist Colin Kaepernick helped pay for another autopsy. And Reverend Al Sharpton has offered tens of thousands of dollars for information that could lead to any arrests. Sharpton spoke at Wells' eulogy earlier this week.
I do not think that it is appropriate for either side of opinions to prevail without a backup and fair investigation. We cannot say it was racist, but we cannot say it was not racist.
Nick Juden, an investigative reporter with the Mississippi Free Press who's been following the case, spoke with us about the details that are known.
We know that Nolan went to Horn Island with a group of friends that he'd known for a long time.
The group arrived on three separate boats late in the morning of July 4th for a party.
Now, the specific boat that he came on then returned to the shore around 4:30 p.m. because of, in their testimony, a bilge pump issue, so a mechanical failure. And there is some audio corroborating this. They reached out to a towing company. Around this time is the last published evidence that we've seen of Nolan Wells alive. The testimony from the friends is essentially that he stayed on the island to continue talking to a girl, and that he said he'd catch a ride back with some of the other friends who came to the island on the same day.
That, Juden says, is a critical piece of the testimony from Wells' friends.
The testimony here, and it is testimony, is saying that rather than just stranding Wells on a crowded, admittedly very populated beach, that there were two other boats staying on the island that he had access to and could leave on. Obviously, it does not appear that Nolan got on either of those boats.
One of his friends contacted his family that evening when Wells did not return, and his family notified authorities. The family ordered an independent autopsy, but the results were inconclusive.
Now, it came back as inconclusive for a couple of really important reasons. One, body parts were retained by the Mississippi medical examiner after the first autopsy, specifically parts of his neck, including the trachea and the hyoid bone. And I really want to stress here that the secondary autopsy itself is clear that this is standard forensic practice, that these are delicate structures which are likely being examined more closely for evidence of, for example, pre-death injury.
But it means the independent autopsy was not able to fully examine the condition of Wells' body. The autopsy also did not include a toxicology report. Civil rights attorney Ben Crump, who is representing the family, said at a news conference this week that the family still had questions, like what were the circumstances surrounding Wells entering the water, and what position the body was in when it was found.
And these are critical questions, without answers to which theories can't possibly be complete. But I can tell you right now that what everyone is waiting on, including the police, the lawyers, and of course Nolan's family, is the official autopsy. So much of this case is entirely determinant on what we find in this autopsy report.
The NAACP passed a resolution last week urging law enforcement and the DOJ to complete a full review of the incident. And last night, the district attorney handling the case said that the autopsy report would be withheld until a grand jury can review it, which she said was standard practice. No one knows yet where LeBron James will spend his next season in the NBA, but tons of people have a lot of money riding on the outcome.
It's been a trading extravaganza that we really haven't seen before when it comes to free agency on the market.
Rick Mace is a sports reporter for The Washington Post.
As of Thursday afternoon, more than $250 million has been traded just surrounding LeBron's decision and what he's going to do.
James has always had a penchant for drumming up media attention, particularly around decisions. But as he reportedly considers a host of teams from the Miami Heat to the Cleveland Cavaliers to the Philadelphia 76ers, a massive sum of money is following each and every drip of new information. On Tuesday night, for example, the Heat posted a video to their YouTube channel labeled as an introductory press conference for James. That drove numbers way up in the Heat's favor on the prediction market Kalshi, even as the team said the video was accidentally made public and it was only created in the event that James did sign there. But that movement points to an issue with markets like Kalshi and Polymarket, and that's the real ambiguity about what constitutes information versus inside information. As Mace said, it's not just a theoretical problem.
We've kind of seen a series of headlines over the past few months of people using inside information to place the bets. One example recently is President Trump, the person that was operating his teleprompter in the White House, was alleged to have used inside information to kind of enter into contracts on prediction markets. So the same thing could happen here. LeBron James obviously knows what he's doing, but that circle of people that know before it becomes public will grow.
Kalshi has added safeguards recently after some of those high-profile incidents, and Polymarket recently partnered with another company to monitor trading activity that might be relying on non-public info. The companies insist that these are not bets because they have no vested interest in outcomes and make money on fees rather than wins or losses. Even as the NBA has partnered with sportsbooks and seems open to prediction markets, the James decision is the exact kind of thing the league has worried about. In fact, the NBA told federal regulators earlier this year they think that people should not be able to wager on a free agency decision.
They said they don't think there should be markets related to officiating, injuries, disciplinary action, player transactions, all these things that they think are kind of susceptible to manipulation or vulnerable to inside information kind of moving the market around.
As regulators and lawmakers try to catch up with this new reality, the money moving around one of the league's greatest players ever might actually lead to some change.
I think this is going to be kind of a flashpoint where the leagues are going to have to decide, hey, how much are we going to push back as we enter into agreements with the Kalshis or Polymarkets of the world? How much do we want to make sure they don't offer these things in the future? You know, LeBron James, he's a unicorn. Everything he does, it transcends sport and the transaction wires. And so it's going to generate a lot more interest and activity.
Even as hundreds of millions have gone into these wagers, it's harder to win earnings. About 69% of accounts on Polymarket and 70% on Kalshi lose money. And on Polymarket, about 77% of gains go to 1% of users. Here are a few other stories we're following today. Vance Belter, the man who shot and killed former Minnesota House Speaker Melissa Hortman and her husband last year, was sentenced to 2 life terms plus 40 years yesterday. Belter pleaded guilty to 6 federal charges against him last month in a plea deal and will avoid the death penalty. In addition to Hortman, he shot and wounded Minnesota State Senator John Hoffman and his wife at their home. He admitted in court last month that he stalked his targets, who were all Democrats, before driving to their homes dressed as a police officer and attempting to kill them. The murder sparked the largest police search in the state's history. Shortly after his guilty plea last month, Hoffman's family released a statement saying, quote, "There is no justice when our family and our state will never truly heal." In Maine, Democrats will formally confirm their pick to replace the former Senate candidate Graham Plattner tomorrow. It seems all but certain it will be former state Senate President Troy Jackson. He was the third place finisher in the state's gubernatorial primary and emerged from a crowded Senate field after Plattner left the race due to accusations of sexual assault, which Plattner denies. Jackson and Plattner campaigned alongside each other during their respective primaries, and Jackson recently told MS Now that he felt misled by the former Senate candidate.
Graham told me point blank that there was nothing in his past that I had to worry about. And he lied to me, and he lied to a lot of us.
Jackson will take on the longtime Republican incumbent Susan Collins in what promises to be an expensive contest that may decide which party controls the Senate. And finally, what happens when you lend out a replica Viking ship and you get it back with some wear and tear on it? That is the dilemma for a Swedish Viking center, which rented out its stock to Universal for the Odyssey. The center is claiming that the ship sustained damage to its stern and mast, and that Universal was supposed to front the bill for that for about $6,000. Now the center is saying they didn't get the money, which the movie studio is disputing. Universal certainly has the cash for it, as the Christopher Nolan epic made more than $264 million in its opening weekend. You can find all these stories and more in the Apple News app. And if you're already listening in the news app right now, stick around for the latest episode of Apple News in Conversation. This week, guest host David Greene sat down with David Kirkpatrick, a staff writer at The New Yorker, to unpack the contents of President Trump's recent financial disclosure and where the money is coming from. Kirkpatrick has been tracing Trump's streams of income for years, and he says that Trump's 2025 earnings from his crypto company World Liberty Financial stunned him.
Even as I was reporting on them, I thought, this is so crazy, it can't be right. But you know what? It is right.
If you're listening in the podcast app, you can follow Apple News in Conversation to find that episode. Enjoy the weekend, and I'll be back with the news on Monday.